You're sick with it. I'm carrying Dragonscale, but I don't know you'd rightly call me sick, Peter. By my way of thinking, I'm better than I ever was.
Ben stepped back, keeping his gun leveled on Beth Ann, who opened her door and got out with her hands raised. Without looking away from her, Ben called,
Nelson, didn't I tell you to keep your finger off the trigger? Why did you discharge your weapon?
Nelson stood behind the hedge, holding the 410 so it pointed into the sky.
It stopped him running, didn't it? Ben said. While you were blazing away, Beth Ann was speaking into an open mic. Oops! What's that mean? Jamie asked.
It means if you're smart, you'll get out of here while you still have time to run, Beth Ann said.
There's a good chance they heard the shot over the radio and are already sending additional officers.
Oh, I don't think so, Ben said. Around the time I had to stop going to work, we were already stretched so thin it could take upwards of half an hour to get any kind of backup, and that was months ago. Everyone knows things have only gotten worse. Even if dispatch was listening, they're not going to send the cavalry because they might have heard something irregular in the background.
Yes, that's true, Peter agreed on his knees in the road, hands stretched out to either side. But it isn't just dispatch listening these days. You don't know who's on the radio anymore. Now what the heck is that supposed to mean? Ben asked.
But if Peter answered, Harper couldn't hear it. His voice was drowned out by the caterwaul of the ambulance turning onto Verdon off Sagamore. Jamie was the first to move, stepping around Peter, on his knees, and striding toward the ambulance as it pulled in behind the police cruiser. She pointed the Bushmaster through the windshield, calling out as she came forward,
Hey there! Take your hands off the wheel!
Nelson's shotgun went off with a thunderous slam. The ambulance leapt forward, like a person jumping in surprise. Jamie sprang aside to get out of the way, and even still was clipped by the driver's side mirror. The Bushmaster was knocked out of her hands and would have hit the road if she hadn't been wearing the strap around her neck. The cop named Peter got up on one foot, the other knee still touching the road, and the shotgun blammed again. Peter's head snapped back. His wispy gray comb-over flipped up. He began to sink backward, as if he were performing some sort of advanced yoga pose.
Stop shooting! Someone screamed.
Harper never knew who. For all she knew, she was hearing herself. The ambulance began to back up. Its bent front bumper was tangled in the police cruiser's rear fender, and it dragged Peter and Beth Ann's car along with it through a cloud of smoke. Ben watched the ambulance dragging the cruiser away in a kind of gaping bafflement, as if he himself had been shot. When Beth Ann took off, she did not try to grab for Ben's gun, and she did not try to draw her own. Instead, she pushed herself off the sidewalk and gave Ben a kind of comical shove, one hand in his face, the other on his breastbone. He reeled. She turned, took one step, then a second. Ben's right foot plunged over the curb. He pitched backward toward the street. His pistol cracked. Beth Ann buckled, pushing her chest out, arching her back. Then she straightened and ran another half dozen steps, her hand falling to the butt of her Glock, before she suddenly fell face first onto the icy, unshoveled sidewalk. The tires of the ambulance smoked and spun. Jamie got her hands back on the Bushmaster and lifted it to her shoulder, hollering something Harper couldn't hear. There was a wrenching clang of tortured steel. The rear fender of Peter and Beth Ann's cruiser fell in the road. The ambulance, free, shot backward, straight into a telephone pole, banged to a stop once more. The tires screamed and it jolted forward, veering straight toward Jamie. The Bushmaster went off in a series of pops. The shotgun sounded with a clap. Ben stepped into the road, leveled his pistol, and fired one shot after another. The windshield of the ambulance exploded. The siren choked, made a dismal, dying wail, and went silent. A headlight exploded with a bright snap. Jamie backpedaled, moving aside, then stood there, watching dumbly as the ambulance glided sedately past, no longer gaining speed, but moving at a surreal creep like a zombie in a horror movie. They watched as it rolled over Peter the cop's body. Peter's spine snapped like a tree branch. The ambulance trundled on another 5 yards before thumping to a stop against the curb, the fuming, bullet-riddled grill less than 20 feet away from the front of Ben's Challenger. 3. Ben Patchett stood at the ready, like a shooter taking target practice at the gun range. He had swiveled around to follow the passage of the ambulance as it rolled by him, firing the whole time. At last, he lowered the gun and looked around at the broken glass and the blood in the street with a kind of stunned amazement. They were all shining, all of them. Even Harper was lit up, could feel the tingling thrill of the dragon scale racing over her skin. Nothing created a sense of harmony, it seemed, like a communal act of homicide. "Whoa!" Nelson cried, a kind of ragged excitement, maybe even euphoria, in his voice. "Anyone hurt? Is anyone hurt?" Ben shouted, almost screamed. "Is anyone hurt, you jackass?" Harper had never heard him say anything so profane. "What's it look like? We got 4 corpses here. Why in God's name did you start shooting?" "I shot the back tire out," Nelson said, "so they couldn't get away, the guys in the ambulance. They were backing up, didn't you see? They didn't start backing up until you started shooting." A vein stood up in the center of Ben's forehead, an ugly red twig pulsing across his brow. "No, no, I swear they were making a run for it. Seriously. Jamie, you were standing right there. Weren't they making a run for it?" Jamie stood over Peter the cop, pointing her bushmaster at the corpse, as if he might get up and start running again. Peter, however, was bent over backward and grotesquely squashed, a red tread mark printed across his flattened chest. Some of his guts had been forced up and out his mouth in a bluish-red mass of slick tissue. "What?" Jamie lifted her head and looked from Norman to Ben, her face bewildered. She put a finger behind her right ear. "What did you say? I can't hear anything." "Look, maybe if we had instant replay, we could go back and see what really happened. I don't know. I thought they were trying to drive away. Someone had to do something, so I shot out a tire." Nelson shrugged. "Maybe I made a rookie mistake. If you want to lay all the blame on someone, go ahead. Pile it on. I don't mind being the scapegoat here." Ben looked as if he had been knifed, mouth open, eyes wide and unblinking. He went to put his pistol back in his holster and missed on the first 2 attempts. Jamie came around to Harper's side of the car and let her out of the back seat. "Come on," Jamie said. "Let's go." Moving around to open the trunk and collect the duffel bags. Harper felt short of breath, as if she had stepped into shockingly cold water. Her legs wobbled. A high-pitched drone rang in her ears. She walked to the ambulance, glass crunching underfoot, and looked in. The driver was a young black woman who had dyed her close-cropped hair a ripe banana yellow. Her mouth was open as if to call out. Her eyes were wide and startled. Her lap was filled with blue safety glass. Harper couldn't see a bullet hole and didn't know what had killed her. She had no doubt the driver was dead. She could see it in her face. But she pulled open the door and put 2 fingers on her neck to feel for a pulse. When she did, the driver's head slid over to rest on her right shoulder, leaving a smear on the vinyl headrest. A single bullet had entered her open mouth and exited through the base of her skull. The woman in the passenger seat, a tiny, small-boned woman zipped into a blue EMT jumpsuit, groaned. She had dropped onto her side, face down across the front seat. Harper left the driver, made her way around to the passenger side. She opened the door and climbed onto the step. There was blood on the passenger seat and blood soaking the passenger's right shoulder. Harper suspected a bullet had pulverized her scapula on the way through. Painful, but hardly fatal. Someone she could help. She felt a relief so intense it left her weak. "Can you hear me?" Harper asked. "You have a wound in your shoulder. Do you think you can move?" But even as Harper spoke to her, she had the growing sense there was more wrong than a smashed shoulder. It was the way the small woman was breathing. Her inhalations required a sobbing effort. Her exhalations were worse, made a strenuous gurgling sound. Harper put one knee up in the footwell, leaning into the ambulance and taking the woman by the hip, lifting and rolling her slightly. The EMT had another bullet wound, dead in the center of her chest. Blood drenched the front of her jumpsuit. Bubbles frothed in the wound when she exhaled. The woman's eyes strained from her head in pain. She stared up at Harper, and Harper stared back, and then recoiled in surprise, bumping her head on the dash. Harper knew her. She had crossed paths with her a few times in the summer, when they were both working at Portsmouth Hospital. The EMT was pretty, in a freckled, boyish way. Upturned nose, pixie cut. "Charity," Harper said, remembering her name and saying it aloud in the same moment. "We worked at the hospital together. I don't know if you remember me. I'm going to take care of you. You have a collapsed lung. I'm going to step away and get the gurney and put you on it. You need a chest compress and oxygen. You're going to be all right. Do you understand me? I'll be right back and we'll make you more comfortable." Charity gripped Harper's hand and squeezed. Her fingers were warm and sticky with her own blood. "I remember you," Charity said. "You're little Mary Poppins. You're the one who was always humming that song, Spoonful of Sugar." Harper smiled in spite of the blood and the stink of gun smoke. "That's me." "Want to know something, little Mary Poppins?" Charity asked. Harper nodded. "You and your friends just murdered 2 EMTs. I'm going to die, and you aren't going to save me. Eat a spoonful of sugar with that, bitch." She shut her eyes and turned her face away. Harper flinched, bumped her head again, backing away. "You aren't going to die tonight. Hang on, Charity. I'll be right back." Harper was aware her own voice was an octave too high, uneven and unconvincing. Harper hopped down from the cockpit. She was halfway around to the back end of the ambulance when Ben gently took hold of her upper arm. He said, "You can't do anything for her, you know. I wish to God you could, but you can't. Get your hand off me." Harper twisted her biceps free from his grip. Mindy walked past her, an empty duffel bag in each hand, deliberately not looking at the squashed police officer in the road. Red and blue lights chopped the night into a series of frozen moments, little slices of time captured in stained glass. "We have to get what we came for and go," Ben said. "There'll be more police soon. We can't be here when they arrive, Harper." "You should have thought of that before you shot up the street, you assholes. You stupid assholes. If they get even one of us, they get us all. If you love Nick and Renee and Father Story and the firemen, you'll get what we came for and roll." "I'm going to die and you aren't going to save me. Eat a spoonful of sugar with that, bitch." Harper heard it again in her head and felt a frustration, a rage so intense it was like nausea. She wanted to hit Ben, to scream at him. She wanted to hit him over and over while she wept. Instead, she spoke in a soft voice that wavered with emotion and which she hardly recognized. She was unused to hearing herself plead. "Please, Ben. Please. Just a chest compress. She doesn't have to die. I can save her. I can make sure she'll still be alive when the next police car gets here. Pack what we need for camp, and we'll see if there's time," he said, and she understood she would not be allowed even to apply the chest compress. She lowered her head and went to the rear of the ambulance. Mindy was already standing in the brightly lit interior with its stainless steel surfaces, its rolling gurney, its drawers and cabinets. Already Harper's sense of sickened frustration was congealing into a rancid form of grief. They had done the killing. Now it was time for the looting. On some level she felt the plan had always been to murder and steal. And she had not only gone along with it, she had all but engineered it. She packed without thought. She filled the cooler with plasma and fluids and sent Mindy away with it. She packed the first duffel, then the second, collecting the items every respectable health clinic would stock and that her own infirmary lacked. Reels of gauze, bottles of painkillers, ampoules of antibiotics, sterile thread and sterile tools, a bundle of second skin burn gel pads. By the time Mindy got back, Harper was on her knees, packing adult diapers into the second bag. She was using them to insulate and cushion little glass bottles of epinephrine and atropine, and wondering if she could squeeze in an oxygen tank. Jamie banged her fist on the steel door.
Time! We gotta move!
No, 2 more minutes.
Mindy, I want that cervical collar, and I want...
It's time, Jamie said, and she reached in for the duffel that was already full and slid it out on the ground.
Go on, Mindy said. I'll get the cervical collar, Miss Willows.
Harper cast an unhappy, half-desperate look around at open cupboards and drawers hanging open. Her gaze found the heart start paddles, the kit no bigger than the briefcase for a laptop.
Nelson! Harper cried.
He appeared at the rear of the ambulance, eyes goggling in that strangely smooth, unlined pink face that always made her think of a fat baby.
The heart start paddles, Harper said. I want them.
She jumped out of the back, duffel in one hand and a compression bandage in the other. She brushed past Nelson and walked quickly to the front of the ambulance.
I came as soon as I...
Charity was no longer breathing in that strenuous way, or in any other way. Harper rolled her onto her back and wrenched down the zipper at the front of the jumpsuit. When it stuck, she tore the jumpsuit open. The bullet hole was just below her right breast. Harper touched Charity's wrist to take her pulse. Nothing. She felt sure there had been nothing for a long time now.
Nursey, Jamie said. You can't help her, but there's people back at camp you can. Come on, let's go home.
Her voice was not unkind. Harper let Jamie draw her by the elbow out of the ambulance. She got turned around, back towards Ben's Challenger. Harper reached out blindly and found the straps of her duffel.
I'll gather up the others. See you at the car, Jamie said.
Harper walked around to the open trunk of Ben's car, moving in a daze. She heaved the duffel into the back, next to the cooler, and then looked up the street. At the end of Verdun Avenue, there was that blackened, burned-out concrete shell that had once been a CVS drugstore. Out past the CVS, right at the intersection of Verdun and Sagamore, a white windowless van idled. Call letters were painted on the side, words dragging cartoonish streamers of flame. WKLL, home of the Marlboro Man. At a distance, Harper could hear another vehicle coming down Sagamore, something heavy and slow. Her ear caught the soft blasting hiss of air brakes and the diesel whine of a heavy engine. It sounded like a school bus. The passenger side window of the WKLL van was down. A man leaned out of it with a spotlight and flipped the switch. A blinding beam of light, as dazzling as a fresh-cut diamond, struck Nelson Heinrich, nailing him to the spot in the middle of the road. Nelson had just climbed out of the ambulance with the heart start paddle kit in both hands. He squinted into the brightness. A low squall of feedback whined from a brace of speakers on the roof of the van. Harper felt blood beginning to rush inside of her, her internal chemical carousel getting up to speed. The voice that followed boomed like the voice of God. It was the hoarse, roughened voice of a man who has screamed his way through an entire Metallica concert. Harper had heard the voice live only a few days before, in her own house. Before that, she had listened to him often enough on the radio, narrating the apocalypse and providing the end of the world with a soundtrack that was heavy on 70s cock rock.
What are we doing tonight, folks? Looting an ambulance? There weren't some nuns needed raping or an orphanage to burn down? Well, I'll tell you what. I got good news, and I got better news. I'm the Marlboro Man. Here tonight with the Seacoast Incinerators, and if you're looking for medicine, boy, have you come to the right place. We got just the thing for treating you infected bags of meat. The even better news is, there's an ambulance right here. So after we're done with you thieving and killing fucks, we won't have to go very far to find the body bags. Get under cover! Ben screamed.
The side door of the WKLL van slid open. Harper had never seen anything like the gun mounted there outside of a movie. She did not know the make or caliber. Did not know she was looking at an M2 Browning 50 caliber. Only that it was the type of gun you usually saw bolted on top of tanks or inside combat helicopters. She could see it was belt-fed.
A chain of bullets hung down into an open metal case. A man sat on a low stool behind it, wearing a pair of bright yellow ear defenders. She had two thoughts before the night was crushed into fragments of sound and white flame. The first was, absurdly, that such a gun could not possibly be legal. The second was that the other vehicle, the one rolling into sight just past the ruin of the CVS, was not a school bus, of course, but an orange freight liner with a plow the size of an airplane wing across the front, and Jacob behind the wheel. 4. The Browning went off in a series of deep concussions that could not be thought of merely as sound. Harper felt those stammering blasts through her entire body, in her teeth, in her eyeballs. The ambulance shuddered. Pulverized tar leapt up from the street as the Browning strafed from left to right. Bullets passed through Nelson Heinrich's legs, tearing them apart and throwing red smoke. Blood turned to a cloud of vapor. His right leg folded backward at the knee, like the leg of a praying mantis. The portable defibrillator dropped a shower of white sparks. Nelson jittered like a man at a tent revival show getting a dose of the Holy Spirit. Harper went down on her hands and knees, dropping behind the rear of Ben's Challenger. From around the tire, she saw Ben in Peter and Beth Ann's cruiser. He knelt in the driver's seat, leaning out with his automatic pistol. She saw the gun muzzle flash, but couldn't hear the report over the merciless thudding of the .50 caliber. Then Ben jerked his head back into the car and shrank down. In the next instant, Peter and Beth Ann's police cruiser was rocking from side to side, as if in a gale. Windows erupted, bullets whanged into steel, blew out tires, sheared off the open driver's side door. It fell with a bang into the street, sprang open the trunk, smashed taillights. Jamie had retreated behind the front of the ambulance, sunk into a crouch, Bushmaster between her legs. The Dodge Challenger was only a dozen steps from where she was taking shelter, but it might as well have been in a different county. Trying to cross that distance made about as much sense as diving headfirst into a wood chipper. Then the shooting was over. Distantly, Harper heard the jingle-jangle of empty cartridges falling into the road. The air throbbed with reverberations.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa!" shouted the Marlboro man. "I saw AC/DC with Bon Scott in 79, and they sounded like pussies compared to our noise. You all lay still, unless you want to hear our encore. Let me tell you what's going to happen now. You're all going to..."
A gun popped from the rear of the ambulance. After the racket of the Browning, Mindy Skilling's little silver pistol sounded like a party cracker.
"Run for it, Mr. Patchett!" Mindy shrieked. "I'll cover you! Run! Run! Everyone run! My life for Mother Carol! My life for the Bright!"
The gun popped again and again. Mindy was no longer in the ambulance, but crouched on the sidewalk behind the ambulance's rear end.
"Mindy!" Ben shouted. "Mindy, don't!"
The Freightliner ground into first gear and lurched forward with a raggedy diesel roar. It crashed over a curb, wrenching a holly bush out of the ground and flinging it aside in a shower of dirt. The truck found second gear with a steely crunch and third a moment later. Filthy smoke gushed from the exhaust pipe behind the cab. Mindy's little gun popped and popped, bullets spanging musically off the plow. At the last moment, Jamie Close dropped her Bushmaster and scrambled away from the ambulance, clambering on all fours across the sidewalk to take shelter behind a telephone pole. The Freightliner hit the ambulance, picked it up off the asphalt, and tossed it across the yard of 10 Verdon Avenue. Mindy Skilling was still behind it, and she went along for the ride, was under it when it rolled on top of her and slid across the lawn. The ruin of the ambulance wrenched up grass and earth, left a wide, smoking skid mark behind it. One of Mindy Skilling's boots was squashed deep into the dirt, but the rest of her was beneath the deformed wreck. She had said it was hard to die in front of an audience, but in the end she had made it look easy.
"Who else wants to be a hero?" the Marlboro man's voice boomed from the loudspeakers. "We got all night, plenty of ammo, and the next best thing to a tank. You can come on out with your hands up and play Let's Make a Deal. or you can try and fight it out. But let me tell you, if you decide to make a scrap of it, not one of you will live to see the light of day. Does everyone understand me?
No one spoke. Harper couldn't find her own voice. She had thought nothing could be louder than the sound of the 50 caliber lighting up the street. But the freightliner crashing into the ambulance had been like a 75-gun broadside from a ship of the line. She felt incapable of even beginning a thought, let alone completing one. One moment ticked by, and then another. And finally it was the Marlboro man who spoke up yet again. Only this time there was a distracted uncertainty in his voice.
"The fuck is that?" he said, his voice muted.
Harper wasn't sure he meant to broadcast that one. The street brightened, as if the sun had, impossibly, jumped into the sky. A rushing gold light flared and lit the road with a perfect noontime clarity, or almost perfect. That unseen sun was moving, swooping straight up the lane. A hot summer gale rocked the cars, blasting them with the smell of the 4th of July, a perfume of cherry bombs, campfires, hot tarmac. Then it was gone, and the darkness dropped back over Verdun Avenue. The Marlboro man chuckled nervously.
"You want to tell me the fuck that was? Someone shoot a flare gun at us?"
The light began to build again. A bronze burning glow that made the spotlight shining from the van as unnecessary as a penlight at high noon in July. Harper rose to one knee and twisted her head to see over the roof of the Challenger, just in time to see a teardrop of flame, the size of a private jet, plunging out of the night above. 5. In the first instant of seeing it, the light was so intense, Harper was half-blinded and could not make out any features of what was falling upon them. It was simply a blaze of red glare, plunging toward the stretch of road between the WKLL van and the Dodge Challenger. It was 30 feet above the road and still dropping when the bolt of flame opened wings to reveal the blazing, monstrous bird within. The heat deformed the air around it. Harper saw it through a blur of tears. At the sight, she was struck through with wonder, with terror. The people who had witnessed the mushroom cloud rising from Hiroshima could have felt no less. It was 24 feet across from burning wingtip to burning wingtip. Its open beak was large enough to swallow a child. Feathers of blue and green flame, yards long, rippled from its tail. It made no sound at all, aside from a rushing roar that reminded Harper of a train passing through a subway tunnel. Time snagged in place. The bird hovered less than a dozen feet above the road. The blacktop beneath it began to smoke and stink. Every window on the street reflected the bonfire light of the phoenix. Then it was moving, and so was Harper. Its wings lashed at the air, and it was like someone had thrown open the hatch to a great furnace. A withering billow of chemical heat rolled down the road, and the Dodge Challenger shook in the gale. Harper was crawling around to the driver's side door. The phoenix launched itself at the white van. One wing stroked a hedge and the brush ignited, became a wall of flame. The phoenix flew into the open side door of the van. Harper had a glimpse of the gunman behind the Browning shrieking and raising his arms in front of his face. The front doors were flung open. The driver and the passenger toppled into the street. The massive bird of flame hit the van so hard, it went up on two tires, tilting toward the driver's side, threatening to overturn before crashing back onto all four wheels. The interior boiled with fire, with threshing wings of flame. A bullet went off with a metallic spow, then another. Then 50-caliber ammunition was exploding like kernels of popcorn, blam, blam, blamming inside the white van, flashing as the shells went off, bullets bonging off the roof, the walls, deforming the vehicle from the inside. Harper hoisted herself behind the wheel of Ben's Challenger, sat on broken glass. The keys were in the ignition. She stayed low, just peeking over the dash, while she started the car. Up the road, the Freightliner turned in a slow circle, tires chewing up the snow and dirt in front of 10 Verdun. Harper threw the cruiser into drive and stamped on the gas. She only went a short distance, though, less than 5 yards, before slamming one foot on the brake. The Challenger shrieked to a stop, close to where Jamie was crouched behind a telephone pole. Jamie broke and ran, crossed the open blacktop, and dived into the passenger seat. She was saying something, shouting something, but Harper didn't hear and didn't care. Up the road, the Phoenix emerged from the side door of the van, stretching its head out on a comically long neck, as if to scream triumphantly into the night. The van continued to shake and jump on its springs while the ammo popcorned inside the wreck. The windshield exploded. Someone was screaming. Harper launched the Challenger up the street, swerving across half-melted rubble to pull alongside the shot-up police cruiser. Ben flung himself out, hobbled across the space between the two cars, and tumbled into the back seat face down, his legs hanging out the door. The air reeked of burning tires. The Freightliner roared and leapt up the street at the van and the Phoenix. The plow struck the side of the Econoline with a shattering clang and tossed it aside as if it were an empty shoebox. The van rolled, spraying blue sparks, the roof collapsing. The Freightliner charged after it, hitting it again, flipping it to the far side of the cross street, Sagamore Road. The Phoenix exploded from the gaping windshield and streaked into the sky. Much diminished, Harper saw. Minutes earlier, it had been the size of a Lear jet. Now it was smaller than a hang glider. Her foot found the gas pedal. The Challenger jumped forward hard enough to shove her all the way back into her seat. Ben's legs were still hanging out the rear door. He had wrapped seatbelts around his hands to keep from being tossed out, was kicking his feet to try and pull himself farther into the car. She looked out as they launched themselves past Nelson Heinrich on his back in the street, legs splintered and smashed, folded at improbable angles. The defibrillator sat on the dead man's chest, the plastic black with scorch marks, a bullet hole the size of a fist in the center of it. At least she thought he was dead. It was only after they were well past him that Harper wondered if Nelson had turned his head to watch them go. The Freightliner filled the road before them. Harper swerved toward the parking lot in front of the burned-out CVS. The Challenger jumped the curb. Harper felt herself lift weightlessly off the seat. The car hit the lot with a spray of sparks, and Ben howled, still hanging on. They slewed onto Sagamore Road, and Harper gave it all the gas it would take. A bronze light lit their way from above. The Phoenix escorted them for a quarter of a mile, a brassy blaze that made headlights all but unnecessary, and then it soared out and ahead of them. For a few moments it was gliding this way and that in front of the car, a vast kite of bright fire. At last, with a final dip of its wings, it left them, rose in a sputtering rush into the night, and was gone, disappearing over trees to the east. An especially hard piece of glass or steel was jabbing Harper in the butt, and she reached under her to get rid of it. It turned out to be the cell phone Mindy Skilling had used to call 911. Without really considering it, she pushed it into the pocket of her snow jacket. No one saw. 6. Harper was unprepared to get back and find the infirmary full of people, lamps burning in every corner, and the air humid from the close press of bodies. She knew before anyone spoke to her, just from the way they looked at her, that they were in a panic, and she wondered how they already knew about the massacre on Verdun Avenue. The waiting room was crammed with lookouts. Michael Lindquist, the neighbor's twins, Chuck Cargill, Bowie, a few others Harper didn't know by name. Allie was there, too, and looked so afraid, so pale and distraught and starved, Harper couldn't feel any anger toward her. Norma Held sat in the corner, a quaking mound of white flesh in a flower-print dress. What surprised Harper most was to find Carol there, bundled into a threadbare pink and yellow robe that was so old the colors had taken on an exhausted, thin hue. Those words, exhausted, thin, applied as much to Carol herself. Her skin was stretched tight over the skull beneath, her eyes burning dangerously hot in their sockets. Harper had an arm around Ben's waist, helping him stumble skip along. His left cheek, his left forearm, His left hand and his left buttock were cactus with glass needles. Jamie was right behind them, lugging the styrofoam cooler full of plasma. They had spilled far more blood than they had brought home.
What? Harper asked. Why are you all...
Seizure, Carol said. My father had a seizure. While you were out there, and he was here alone, his heart stopped. He died.
7.
Later, Nick told Harper everything, using a combination of sign language and notes. He was there for the whole thing. He was holding Father Story's hand when the old man stopped breathing. Nick had been in a nervous state when Harper left with Ben to hit the ambulance. Somehow he had worked out what was up and was sure someone was going to die. Michael Lindquist had tried to settle him down. They had beans and tea and played Battleship. The second time Nick yawned, Michael said it was time for a nap, and even though Nick said he wasn't tired, he was asleep in the cot next to his grandfather inside of 5 minutes. He had a dream of light falling in the darkness, a torch dropping from a sky of midnight blue. The torch plummeted behind some hills and there was a red flash, and the world began to shiver and rattle, as if some hidden scaffolding beneath the green grass was coming apart. Nick jumped awake, but the clattering sound continued, which was when he saw it. Father Story's head snapping from side to side and foam running from the corners of his mouth. Father Story's whole bed jittered and shook. Nick ran into the waiting room, where Michael was on watch, flipping through a ranger rick that was older than Nick himself. He dragged Michael off the couch and propelled him into the ward, hauled him along to Father Story's bedside. Michael froze at the foot of the cot, rigid with shock. Nick ran around his cot to his little satchel of clothes and books and dug out the most valuable item in all the world that night, his slide whistle. He shoved up a window and began to blow. It was not the fireman who answered the call, but Allie and half a dozen lookouts. By the time they got there, Father Story had gone still. His chest had ceased its labored rise and fall. His eyelids had a gray, sickly pallor. Nick held his cold, gaunt hand, the skin loose on the bones, while Michael wept with the savagery of a small, bereft child. Allie brushed past them both. She used a finger to scoop the foam and vomit out of Father Story's mouth, put her lips over his, and exhaled into his lungs. She braided her fingers together and began to thrust against the center of his chest. She had learned CPR 2 summers before, when she was a counselor in training at Camp Wyndham, had received her instruction and certification from John Rookwood. So, in some ways, the fireman had answered the whistle after all. She was at it for close to 5 minutes, a long, desperate, silent, timeless time, driving her hand down onto his chest and breathing into his mouth in front of a steadily growing audience. But it wasn't until Carol arrived, until she shoved through the curtain and screamed, "Dad!" that Father Story coughed, gagged, and with a weary sigh, began to breathe on his own again. "Aunt Carol called him back from the dead," Nick wrote Harper. "Your sister called him back," Harper scribbled in reply. But she had the unpleasant notion that most people would think the same as Nick and would credit Carol with a kind of miracle. After all, she already drove back death by leading them in song every day. Was this really so different? Once again she had confronted death, armed only with her voice, and once again the doomed had been saved. Harper spent an hour at Father Story's side, removing the feeding tube she had run down his nostril, getting him on a clean drip, changing his diaper and the pillowcase, which was stained with an acrid-smelling mix of vomit and blood. His pulse was strong but erratic, speeding along for a few beats, slowing, then staggering back into a hurry. His whiskery face was gray, almost colorless, and his eyelids were open on slits to show the whites of his eyes. A stroke, she thought. He was stroking out, a little at a time. Whatever she had hoped or believed up until then, she thought now it was very unlikely the good old man would ever open his eyes or give her a smile again. She dug up tweezers, sterile thread, a needle, bandages, and iodine, and went looking for Ben Patchett. By then it was early morning, the light watery and dismal, which perfectly mirrored how she felt. She found Ben with Carol in the waiting room. He sat with one cheek of his ass on the edge of the coffee table, keeping his weight off the other cheek. He had been methodically picking the largest pieces of glass out of his face and arm and making a pile of them, a glistening heap of bright shards and shiny red needles. Most of the rest had left, though Michael and Allie remained. They sat on the couch, holding hands. Michael had stopped crying, but there were white lines etched on his cheeks, tracing the path of his tears. Jamie leaned against the door. The side of her face was swollen in a ripe red bruise. Carol said, "He's dying." "He's stable. He's getting fluids. I think he's fine for now. You're tired, Carol. You should go home. Try and rest. Your father needs you to be strong." "Yes, I will be. I intend exactly that, to be strong." Carol fixed Harper with a fevered, unblinking stare. "Here is a thought for you. If my father had died, someone in this camp, maybe a few someones, would be glad. Whoever bashed in his head is praying for him to die. You want sickness? There are people in this place who wish my father dead with all their hearts, who probably wish me dead. I don't know why. I can't make sense of it. I only want us all to be safe, safe and good to each other. But there are some who want my father gone, who want me gone, who want to tear us apart and turn us against each other. That's sickness, Nurse Willows, and nothing you brought back from the ambulance can cure it. It can't be cured. It can only be cut out." Harper thought Carol sounded overtired and overwrought, and didn't think this was worth replying to. She shifted her gaze to Allie. Harper wanted to thank her for saving Father Story's life, but when she opened her mouth, she remembered how Allie had stood there and watched while the other girls kicked snow on her and cut off her hair. The words died before they made it to her lips. Instead, she spoke to Ben. "Come into the ward and get those pants off. I want to clean your wounds." Before Ben could rise to his feet, Carol spoke again. "You walked away from my father once, and you were almost captured. You walked away a second time, and my father had a fit and almost died. He did die, and was called back. You aren't walking away again. You will stay here in the infirmary until he recovers." "Carol," Harper said, struggling with all her heart for tenderness, "I can't promise you he will recover. I don't want to deceive you about his chances." "I don't want to deceive you about yours either," Carol said. "You may think letting him die will make room for you and the fireman." "What?" Harper asked. "But when my father's time in this camp is over, so is yours, Miss Willows. If he dies, you're done here. I want you to understand the stakes. You said yourself it is time for me to be strong. I agree. I need to be strong enough to hold people to account, and that is what I mean to do." The dragon scale scrawled on Harper's chest prickled painfully, heating up against her sweater. "I will do everything I can," Harper said, struggling to keep her voice even. "I love your father. So does John. He doesn't have any interest in taking over or running the show. Neither do I. Carol, I just want a safe place to see this baby into the world. That's it. I'm not looking to undermine anyone or anything. But you need to understand, if he does die, despite my best efforts..." "If that happens, you go," Carol said. There was suddenly a new calm in her voice. She was sitting straighter, her pose almost regal. "And so I trust you will not let it happen." Harper's breath was fast and short. For the second time in one night, she felt like she was pinned down, trapped by lethal fire. "I can't promise I can keep him alive, Carol. No one could promise that. He's been grievously injured, and his age makes a full recovery very unlikely." She paused, then said, "You don't know what you're saying. Sending me away would put the whole camp at risk. What if I was picked up by the sort of people who tried to kill us tonight? They'd force me to tell everything I know. That's what Ben says." Not if your baby was here with us, Carol said. You'd keep quiet then, no matter what they did to you. Of course I wouldn't send you away until after you gave birth, no matter what happens to my father. And of course I wouldn't punish the infant by sending him away with you. That's no way to treat a child. No. If my father dies, you go, but the baby will stay here with us to ensure your silence. I'd look after him myself.
8. Harper drew the black thread through Ben's cheek. He shut his eyes, screwing his face up in pain. She gave the line a sharp yank to make him look at her.
Did you hear her? Harper whispered. Her heart was still whacking away in her chest. Ben, did you hear the crazy coming out of her?
Ben sat on her cot. They were in the ward, away from the others. No one else in immediate earshot except Father Story and Nick, and neither of them was listening. Outside the windows, ranks of icicles dripped bright water in the milky glow of the sun. Ben drew a thin, whistling breath.
Nurse, do you think you could please leave my face on my skull? I'm kind of attached to it.
She hissed.
I can't promise anyone I can keep Father Story alive. I can't promise to save him. I want to know what you're going to do if he dies. Are you going to be the one who pulls my baby out of my arms? No, no. I wouldn't take your kid from you, Harper, he whispered back. But I'm sure there are plenty of people who would, if Carol told them it had to be done. Jamie Close, Norma Held. And you just stand by and let it happen?
A shadow moved across the curtain between the ward and the waiting room.
Carol? Allie?
Ben took a deep breath, and when he spoke again, his voice was raised so he could be heard in the next room, and probably halfway to the cafeteria.
Almost everyone in this camp has been taken from someone. Almost everyone is an orphan in some way. Your baby would fit right in. I wouldn't like to see it happen, but there's a lot of things I've had to live with that I didn't like. I'm sure I could manage one more. What I won't do is bargain in secret with you or be part of a whispering campaign against Mother Carol. People who are whispering aren't in harmony with the rest of the camp, and the only way we'll survive is if we all speak with one.
Oh, give it a fucking rest, Harper told him and poked him in the face with the needle to give him a stitch he didn't really need.
9. It was close to a week before she turned on the phone. For all that time, she kept it on her in the pocket of her sweats. Several times a day, she would put her hand on it to reassure herself it was still there. It comforted her to move her thumb along its glassy face and smooth steel curves. She didn't dare attempt to use it. For those first days after they returned from the raid, she was uncomfortably aware of being under watch. There was always a lookout in the waiting room, supposedly to protect Father Story. And her guards had a habit of yanking the curtain aside at random moments and sticking a head into the ward on one pretense or another. Harper didn't even have the courage to try and hide it in the ceiling with Harold's notebook. She felt there was too great a chance of someone walking in on her while she was standing on the chair, reaching to move a drop ceiling panel. Harper settled on a date to risk making a call. Her father's birthday was the 19th. He would be 61 if he was alive. Only her self-restraint didn't hold out until then. She woke early on the morning of the 17th with contractions, sharp enough to make her gasp. Her insides were raw dough in the hands of a burly baker who was tediously, methodically, brutally intent on kneading every centimeter of tissue. It was a sensation not unlike being overcome with the cramps of diarrhea, and a sweat prickled on her face while she waited it out. The nurse inside her identified this rhythmic clenching up as Braxton Hicks contractions. Just a little practice for the oncoming main event. The mother-to-be entertained sickening notions of premature birth. She was at 28 weeks. Such a thing was not impossible, especially for a woman who had been exposed to all manner of stress, gunfights, and slaughter. The idea that she might be going into labor, that the baby might be coming right this instant, made her feel as if she were in an elevator that had begun to fall, the cables giving way. But before she could get too worked up, the contractions subsided. leaving her insides as fizzy as if she had chugged a cold Coca-Cola. Blood boomed in her ears, and the thought occurred to her that she ought to make that call today, now, and let her father know she was hoping to give him a grandchild for his birthday. It was incredible to think her parents didn't know she was pregnant, let alone that she was still alive. Her mother would scream, actually scream. Nick was asleep on his side on the next cot, one hand curled beneath his cheek. She had no fears of waking him. He would sleep on even if she made the call right next to his bed. The floor was so cold it hurt to walk across it on bare feet. She shifted aside the curtain for a peek into the waiting room. The boy out there, a kid named Hud Lurie, who often drew fishing duty with Don Lewiston, dozed on the couch, his rifle on the floor. That boy would be eating a rock for breakfast if Ben Patchett stopped by on a spot inspection. Harper let herself into the bathroom and locked the door. She sat on the lid of the toilet and turned on the phone. It had less than a quarter power and only a single bar. She stared at the flat, glassy, impossibly brilliant screen for 10 seconds, then typed in her mother's cell from memory and pressed send. The phone produced a grainy hiss that lasted for 3 seconds. A recording played of a woman with an aggrieved, accusatory voice. "The number you have dialed is not in service. Please check the listing and try again." She tried her father's line next. The phone made a series of rapid beeps, like someone telegraphing a message in Morse code. This was followed by a hideous, angry blatting, and she had to hang up. Her next thought was email. She pulled up the web browser on the phone to sign into her Gmail account. She waited, breathing shallowly, for the login page to appear. It never did. Instead, she was redirected to the Google main page, only it was different now. Instead of a big blank white page with the word Google in the center, she arrived at a page with the word goodbye on it instead. Beneath was a search box and the two familiar buttons. When she had last visited Google, one of those buttons read Google search and the other said, "I'm feeling lucky." Now the button on the left read, "Our search is over." The button on the right read, "We were so lucky." For some reason, maybe because she was still emotionally jangled from her intense bout of contractions, it made Harper damp-palmed and anxious to see the Google page defaced in such a way. She had a feeling that nothing good would come from attempting a search, but she typed in Google Mail in the search box anyway and hit return. Instead of bringing up her results, the words she had typed into the search box hissed, blackened, and crumbled to pixelated ash. Black trails of digital smoke wavered up from a pile of burnt crumbs. It was ludicrous to cry because there was no more Google, but for a moment Harper felt very close to weeping. The idea that Google could collapse and be gone was as hard to imagine as the fall of the Twin Towers. It had seemed at least as permanent a part of the cultural landscape. Maybe it was not just Google she felt like crying for, but all of it. All of the good, smart, clever creations that were sliding away now, sinking into the past. She missed texting and TV and Instagram and microwaves and warm showers and retail therapy and quality peanut butter. She wondered if there was anyone even growing peanuts anymore, and felt very blue, and when she swallowed, she tasted tears. She missed it all, but most of all, she missed her mother and father and brother. And for the first time, she allowed herself to consider the real possibility that she would never hear from any of them again. Harper did not want to wake the lookout in the waiting room with a sudden sob. She clutched the phone between both hands and pressed her knuckles to her mouth and waited out her grief. Finally, when she was sure she had herself under control, she planted a wet kiss on the screen of the phone, said, "Happy birthday, Dad," and turned it off. When she returned to the ward, she hid the phone in the ceiling with the notebook. She slipped back under her sheets and had a nice little cry into her pillow. Soon enough, she was done with tears and feeling sleepy and comfortable. The baby pressed a tentative hand against the stiff, fibrous wall of his cell, fingers spread. She could feel them, she was sure, and seemed to give her a clumsy, comforting pat. She pressed her hand to his, less than half an inch of tissue between them. "Just you and me now, kid," she said. But of course, it had been just the two of them for months.
10. That night, she dreamt of Jacob again, for the first time in months. She dreamt of Jacob in the freight liner, of the headlights rushing toward her, and the engine screaming in a way that seemed to express more hate than any human voice could manage. But Jacob wasn't riding alone anymore. In the dream, how curious, Nelson Heinrich was riding with him.
11. 4 days after she put the phone away, where it would trouble her no more, Michael Lindquist pulled guard duty on the infirmary. He came to see her as soon as his shift began. "Ma'am," he said, sticking his face between the curtain and the doorframe in a way that reminded Harper of Kermit the Frog, nervously studying the evening's audience. "Can I see you about a thing?"
"Of course," Harper said. "No appointments necessary. All forms of health insurance accepted."
He sat on her cot and she pulled a pale green curtain between them and Nick for privacy. She wondered if he was going to ask her about prophylactics. Instead, he wiggled a sheet of paper out of his pocket and offered it to her.
"Just thought you'd want to look at this in private. You never know when Mr. Patchett might pop by to make sure everyone is being good boys and girls."
She opened the note and began to read. "Dear Miss Willows, what happened to you that night in the woods was all my fault. I could have stopped it at any time, and I didn't. I don't expect you to forgive me, but I hope someday I can earn back your respect, or at least your trust. I would apologize to your face, but lately I've been pissing everyone off and I'm confined to the dorm, so I have to tell you this way. I'm sorry, Miss Willows. I never wanted you to get hurt. I never wanted anyone to get hurt. I'm such an asshole. If there's anything I can do to help you, just tell Mike. I would like so badly to make it up to you. You deserve everything and anything. And also, thank you for being a substitute, part-time, all-purpose mom to my brother. You've been better family to him than I have. Please tell him I'm thinking about him and I miss him. While you're at it, give my grandpa a kiss for me. Please, please, please be careful. Hopefully someday your friend again, Allie." Michael sat with his fingers laced together, hands squeezed between his knees. He looked pasty and couldn't stop jiggling one leg. "Thank you for bringing this to me. I know you could get in a lot of trouble carrying secret messages." He shrugged. "It wasn't any big thing."
"It is, though."
Harper felt as lovely and free as a 10-year-old girl on her first day of summer vacation. She had already forgiven Allie everything. She had that in her. Could forgive easily and lightly, with the best feeling in the world. Harper looked at the letter again and frowned. What does she mean, she's confined to the dorm? Michael's eyes widened in comic surprise. He had the least guarded face of anyone Harper had ever met.
"You don't know?" "No. No, of course you don't. You almost never get out of this place. The night you robbed the ambulance, Allie went to see the fireman and tell him what was going down. She's the reason he knew he had to send to Phoenix to make sure you all got back safe. Allie has been in a world of shit ever since. Carol had her removed from the lookouts and made her carry a stone in her mouth for 3 days. The way Carol sees it, Allie chose sides against her and made her look bad in the process. Now she's only ever allowed out of the dorm to do kitchen chores and visit the chapel. And she isn't glowing anymore when we all sing. She just stands there with her head down, not looking at anyone.
That girl saved Tom Story's life, Harper said. How can Carol punish Allie after she saved Tom's life?
Michael said.
What?
The story in camp is that Allie gave up on trying to save Father Story and was just standing there crying when Carol came in and called him back by shouting his name. She called Father Story back from the deep bright, which is where you go when you're dead.
Allie didn't... She wasn't... What nonsense! You were there. Haven't you told? Didn't someone explain what really...
Michael's head sank between his shoulders, and his face assumed a hangdog look. You want to be careful the kind of stories you tell these days. Carol and Ben have their version of what happened. There isn't room for any other versions. When Allie said it wasn't true,
And she did. Ben gave her a stone again for disrespecting authority. The people in this camp these days, well, you might have heard we only speak with one voice now. His head sank still lower. He dropped his gaze.